This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Life expectancy is longer than it used to be in the U.S., but the question is, what is the quality of life in those later years? Many people who live into their 80s and 90s endure a prolonged period of failing health and progressive disability. Many older people are faced with a constellation of health problems that leave them frail and unable to handle even basic activities like dressing and toileting. My guest, Dr. Muriel Gillick, directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program. She's written a new book about living longer and growing frail called Lifelines. Some older people experience a taste of the so-called golden years after retirement, but eventually find themselves too frail for an independent lifestyle.
We certainly like to paint the picture of old age as a time of exploration and travel and playing, and I think that that works to some extent for vigorous older people, and the majority of older people are vigorous, but a significant fraction are not, and the older they get, the less likely they are to remain vigorous and to be able to engage in those sorts of pastimes. The other observation I would make is that it may be fine to play, to indulge in all sorts of things that are just pleasurable after you've worked hard for many years, for a few years. But we're talking about people retiring at age 65 and having a life expectancy of 20 years easily, and that may increase. That's a long time to spend engaged in solely pleasurable activities. So I would add that even if people are not impeded from doing all kinds of things that they think they would have liked to do because of physical frailty, they still want to do something meaningful with their lives, given that it's a large chunk of time.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book, the vigorous elderly are media idols, those who stay strong and independent well into old age and then have the fortune to die rapidly with little fuss. Are you frustrated when you see these media idols, as you put it?
Well, I think it's great that people are able to remain vigorous into old age. I just think that we shouldn't, as you suggest, delude people into thinking that they will necessarily have that fate, and that we need to acknowledge that for many people, old age is not just a time of being full of pep and able to travel and do all the things that you never had time to do before. And I think that as physicians, we need to recognize that we're not going to be able to prevent frailty by encouraging people to exercise better and to eat better and lead righteous lives, that those are all good things to do, and they may play an important role in preventing frailty or delaying its onset for some people, but it's not going to obliterate frailty.
What do you think is the difference in the approach you might take to seeing an older person who has medical problems and side effects problems as opposed to like a general practitioner who'd be seeing the same patient?
Well, hopefully we'd have the same approach, but I think that the physician who's experienced with dealing with frail elderly individuals would start, for example, by looking at all their medications. One thing that we teach our fellows who are becoming specialists in geriatrics to do is to do brown bag medicine, by which we mean make sure that patients, if they're coming to the office, bring all their pills in a little brown bag and dump them all out on the table and find out just what it is that a person is taking. And if they're not in bottles that are labeled, they're the pink pills and the white pills and the red pills, that tells you something also. Another thing that the geriatricians are particularly comfortable doing is to get information from both the patient and from caregivers. That may be family members, it may be a hired caregiver, other individuals who are in close contact with that person, to fill out the story, to get different aspects of the story, to understand how the person is really doing. And I guess a third facet of geriatric care that's very important is to pay attention to function, not just to ask, do you have pain? Do you have trouble with your breathing? But to figure out how much that pain or the breathing problem actually gets in the way of the person leading his life.
Do you find that older people are sometimes less good at accurately describing their symptoms or giving you a kind of accurate report of what they're capable of doing? And I guess what I'm asking is, do they sometimes try to cover up for what they're feeling, to put on a good face or to make it seem like they are more capable than they've really become?
I think if people are asked about what they can do, they will usually say. I think the problem is more often that they're not asked. I think it is true that people will often not volunteer symptoms. They'll assume that it's perfectly normal to have chest pain every morning because, after all, they're 88 years old and they expect to have a certain amount of discomfort. So they may not come right out and tell a physician about a problem that would be important to divulge. I think the other fact that is important here is that older people often have atypical symptoms, so that an older patient with a heart attack may not have the crushing substernal chest pain going down the left arm with sweating and shortness of breath that's in the textbooks and that often describes what younger patients feel. So it may not be that the person is covering up or refusing to tell. It's that they actually have symptoms that are trickier to pin down.
Why are they trickier?
Because they're not the classic symptoms. I give you an example. Often acute confusion is the presentation of severe disease, and that disease can be pneumonia, it can be a heart attack, it can be a urinary tract infection. It's a lot easier to figure out what's going on if the person with the urinary tract infection has pain when he goes to the bathroom, or the person with pneumonia has cough and fever and shortness of breath. For reasons that aren't entirely clear, older people may not have any of those things and instead just have confusion, and you're left with trying to figure out what the cause of the confusion actually is.
You know, a lot of the patients who you see are you know, quite elderly, and they're probably very different now than they were when they were younger. When they were younger, they might have been active professionally or had a very vigorous home and family life. Do the patients often want to tell you who they used to be before they became frail or before they became sick?
Often patients do want to talk about their lives. And sometimes for people who don't volunteer that information, I find it nonetheless useful to ask them about their lives. It gives me a deeper, richer sense of who they are now if I can understand who they were before.
How does that help you?
Well, it helps me in understanding what's important to them. There's certainly, I said before that in contemplating medical treatment, people have to think about what they're trying to achieve, what their goals are. I also talked earlier about how sometimes a person may not want a cane or a walker because they would rather not be safe in exchange for a sense of dignity. So understanding who they've been all their lives can give me a better sense of what's likely to be important to them today. Now, people change, so it's not necessarily the case that the person who's always been fiercely independent is still going to be fiercely independent today, but it certainly gives a strong clue.
My guest is Dr. Muriel Gillick. Her new book is called Lifelines. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Muriel Gillick. She directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program, and she's the Director of Medical Education at the Hebrew Rehabilitation Center for the Aged. She's written a new book called Lifelines, Living Longer, Growing Frail, Taking Heart. I'm sure that you're often in the position of suggesting to one of your older patients that it's time to use a hearing aid or get a walker or start using oxygen regularly. And I think those kinds of things indicate that somebody has crossed a line. They can no longer walk on their own. They need an aid. They can no longer breathe on their own. They need an aid. Or they can't hear on their own. And because those aids are visible, it's like saying to the rest of the world, I can no longer walk myself. I can no longer hear myself. And as a result of that, I think sometimes older people are very reluctant to take the step that they need to take because it symbolizes something to them and to the rest of the world. Do you find that to be true a lot?
I do. I think it's interesting when older people move into, for example, an assisted living facility, a building where everybody has their own apartment. They have some degree of privacy, but they also have communal areas and dining room for everyone, have some degree of assistance. the reaction of many of my patients on entering such a facility is everybody else here is very old. And what they are often saying is they don't see themselves as needing those kinds of aids that you describe. They have a hard time recognizing that they're in that position too. Amusingly, perhaps, if someone enters a nursing home where 90% of the residents are using a walker, it often is a lot easier to persuade an individual to use a walker because that's par for the course. That's what everybody's using. It's much more socially acceptable. So I think that these kinds of devices do have a great deal of symbolic meaning to people and make it hard for them to accept them.
Are you often in the position of trying to convince an older person that even though they don't want to use it, even though it will make them feel uncomfortable on the outside, that they have to use the cane or they have to use the oxygen?
Well, I do sometimes try to persuade people to use things that they don't want to use, but I think we also have to respect their autonomy, and if their sense of self is so devastated by using a cane, for example, and they're willing to take the consequences of a fall, perhaps even a fracture, in exchange for holding on to the sense of who they are a little bit longer, then that's ultimately their choice to make.
Now, what about depression? Do you find that that's a pretty widespread problem among older people?
It is a very common problem, and I've found in thinking about frailty for this book that there are a lot of people who are tipped over the edge because on top of all their physical ailments, they developed depression. And they were perhaps able to cope if they had to take so many pills for high blood pressure and insulin for diabetes and wear trifocals. But when they become depressed on top, it just makes it very difficult to keep going.
So many older people are already on so many drugs treating, you know, heart problems and blood pressure problems and breathing problems and so on. So if you add an antidepressant to that, what are the odds that the antidepressant is going to interact badly with one of the many drugs the person's already taking?
Well, certainly interaction amongst drugs is a big issue in frail elderly patients. The newer antidepressants, the SSRIs, Prozac and its cousins, tend to have fewer side effects and fewer interactions. The tricyclic antidepressants, which are still very good drugs and in certain circumstances are the drugs of choice, are more likely to cause problems. In my book, I talk about one gentleman who developed urinary retention, who couldn't go to the bathroom when he was started on a tricyclic antidepressant. And in fact, the physician caring for him thought that he needed to have prostate surgery, when really what he needed to have was his antidepressant discontinued, and if he needed an antidepressant to be put on a different one. So, yes, drugs are perilous, but they also can be terrifically helpful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Muriel Gillick, and she directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program. She's the author of the new book, Lifelines, Living Longer, Growing Frail, Taking Heart. Are there times when you're really not sure whether treating a problem is the correct thing to do because the person is so frail that the new drug or the new treatment might worsen their quality of life in a way that doesn't make it pay off?
Yeah, I think there are lots of treatments that would make great sense for someone who's very vigorous, and where one has to ask whether the side effects of that treatment, the long-term consequences of their treatment, make it worthwhile for a frail older person. And one of the things that I really enjoy doing is trying to make people and their families, because families are typically a very important part of decision-making, understand what the ramifications are of engaging in a certain course of therapy. The most extreme example is something like surgery or being in an intensive care unit or having attempted cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Not just will these things work short-term, but what will the long-term consequences be? And is it worthwhile to undertake those risks?
How do you help a person decide whether the risks are worth it or not?
What I like to do is to try to talk to people about what matters to them most at that stage of their lives. And the way I tend to think about this is, are people primarily interested in a treatment that will offer them a chance of life prolongation, no matter what the cost? Is that the most important goal for them? Is their most important goal maintaining the functions that they have, hearing, seeing, walking, talking, whatever it is that they are engaged in on a daily basis that really matters to them? Or are they at a point in their lives when the major goal is just to be kept comfortable? And of course, most people want all three of those things. So what I like to do is to talk to people about establishing priorities, trying to figure out which of those is most important at a given point in time, and then looking at whatever intervention we're talking about, whatever treatment we're talking about, and trying to explain to them what consequences I think that treatment will have in terms of their goals, which form of treatment is most likely to achieve the goals that they have for themselves.
You write in your book that when you see patients who are old and frail, you can't help but wonder what keeps them going, what sustains them spiritually as their bodies disappoint or betray them. What are some of the answers you found to that question about what keeps people going?
Well, I think one of the major things that keeps people going is relationships. That in all the individuals that I describe in the book, their friendships, their family are probably the most important in sustaining them. I think that people often need even more than that, and they need to have some sort of occupation, if you will, that they can find meaningful. And that's sometimes not possible to do in a way that's similar to what they've ever done before, and that creates challenge. But I've had patients who delight in spending time with preschoolers, reading to them, or children in elementary school, telling them what life was like in earlier days. Many frail older people have incredible recollections. I remember having one patient who died when she was 98, and I think I took care of her the last 2 or 3 years of her life. And she had grown up in New York City, she remembered New York City in the 20s. And it was fascinating to listen to her talk about what life was like then. She was a great social historian. I think that we need to tap into recollections that people have about different times and places, and that's a meaningful and rewarding kind of activity for the teller of the story and for the listener. I talk about examples of people becoming involved in whatever community they're in, even if it's a nursing home, to be involved in some kind of council or committee in which the residents of that nursing home help influence policy, help shape their lives in that environment. Those are things that benefit others and benefit the individual in question, that help give meaning to life, even someone who's quite physically frail.
Well, Dr. Gillick, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Muriel Gillick is the author of the new book, Lifelines. She directs the Harvard Geriatrics Fellowship Program. This is Fresh Air.